KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Americans are waking up to fire and ice. As the East and Midwest dig out of the snow, multiple wildfires threaten Los Angeles. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Mark Zuckerberg says Facebook and Instagram will no longer fact-check posts, a change made days before Donald Trump returns to the White House. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We've called Stephen Brill, who's in the fact-checking business. Plus, the winter respiratory virus season is here. Flu, RSV, whooping cough, and more. And NASA explains how it hopes to bring rock samples gathered on Mars back to Earth. It is Wednesday, January 8th. Here is wishing a wicked good day to Cynthia Erivo, the actor who starred as Elphaba, turns 38 years old today. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. At least three big wildfires in the Los Angeles area are burning out of control. The Eaton Fire started last night, and it has already burned more than 2,000 acres. Thousands of people have been told to evacuate in the Pasadena-Altadena area. That includes NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory that's nearby. Another fire is the Palisades Fire burning northwest of L.A. That scorched about 3,000 acres. Cherise Wallace lives in the area and is one of the thousands of people told to flee. But the fire erupted so quickly, she says people are having trouble getting out.
At the bottom of the canyon, there was cars piled on top of each other. There was boulders and debris that fell off of the mountain, off the canyon, that was on fire, that was in the middle of the road where people had to abandon their cars.
A third blaze is the Hearst Fire burning north of Los Angeles. That also broke out late last night, but people have already been forced to flee as it has scorched 500 acres and is growing. The Justice Department has announced it is suing six of the nation's largest landlords. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the lawsuit comes as housing costs continue to go up across the country and many Americans struggle to pay their rent.
The Justice Department has filed an amended complaint in its antitrust lawsuit against RealPage, a property management software company that provides technology platforms for the rental housing industry. The lawsuit accuses the property companies of taking part in a scheme to set their rents using each other's competitively sensitive information through common pricing algorithms. The companies being sued include Cushman and Wakefield and Graystar Real Estate Partners. Collectively, the companies named in the suit operate more than 1.3 million units in 43 states and the District of Columbia. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Donald Trump Jr. is visiting Greenland, the autonomous territory of Denmark that his father wants to buy. Terry Schultz reports the Danish government is trying to put an end to any speculation about that.
Donald Trump Jr. says this was a private visit and that he wasn't meeting Greenlandic government officials. Greenlanders have not taken kindly to the president-elect's declaration that their country must become part of the U.S. The island is home to a U.S. military base in a location strategically important for missile defense. In any case, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen says it's not for sale. Greenland is a very, very proud people. It's a language. It's a culture, she told Denmark's TV2. It's a popular which is its own. At a press conference, President-elect Trump reiterated that he believed the U.S. needs control of Greenland for economic security. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President-elect Trump is asking the U.S. Supreme Court for relief from his upcoming criminal sentencing in New York City. He's due to be sentenced on 34 felony convictions stemming from the hush money case involving falsified business records. New York judges have denied Trump's appeals to halt the sentencing, which is set for Friday. The trial judge in the case has already indicated he would not impose prison time as a sentence. If the snow isn't enough of a problem for many people, federal health officials say the annual fall respiratory virus season is now hitting the country hard, too. NPR's Rob Stein has more.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the flu is spiking, and doctors are reporting that some emergency rooms and hospitals are crowded with sneezing, coughing patients. At the same time, RSV is still spreading widely around the country. To top it off, COVID looks like it's starting to surge again. This means lots of kids are missing school, parents are missing work, and grandparents and other vulnerable people are ending up in the hospital. So experts say people should wash their hands a lot, mask up in crowded places, and get the new flu and COVID shots. It's not too late. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The National Weather Service says a new winter storm is developing in the southern U.S. Winter storm watches and advisories are posted from Texas to western parts of Virginia. Some areas could get up to 8 inches of snow. Winter storm warnings are up in parts of Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Just before I went to bed last night, Renee Montaigne, the longtime former host of Morning Edition, sent over photos from her neighborhood showing orange-tinted smoke on the horizon in her part of Southern California. Several wildfires are burning out of control in metro Los Angeles. This morning, one of my colleagues sent me a photo that someone took out of an airplane that was coming in to land at LAX, and there is fire all across the ground. Just this morning, we called a spokesperson for LA Fire who talked about winds exceeding 80 miles per hour in Southern California, embers carrying on those winds. So the fire can spread at more than 80 miles per hour, which is why people in evacuation areas are being told to park in the driveway with the car facing out so they can flee instantly if they have to. NPR's Liz Baker is in Southern California in a neighborhood where there have been some little fires. Liz, what have you been seeing?
Hey, Steve. Well, I've been seeing that same eerie orange glow on the horizon that you mentioned Renee can see. I think a lot of people in Los Angeles can see that because there's now these two really big fires that are very visible from LA. There's another one a little further out. There's two in Riverside now. So we are seeing these fires blow up really quickly overnight. And, you know, no area is spared. This is really just hitting all over the place here in Southern California. Yesterday evening, I went out along the evacuation zone in Santa Monica where you could look out and really get a very clear view of the fire there. And it was just this like bright orange zigzag running straight up the mountain like a lightning bolt. And every time the wind had a big gust, you could just see the fire flare right up into the sky. So, yeah, Steve, things are not great here. And the National Weather Service says we are only now just entering the worst part of this wind event. So buckle up.
When you say wind event, I'm sure it's no surprise to you, but it hadn't quite occurred to me. 80-mile-an-hour or more winds mean that this fire can go 80 miles an hour someplace that in seconds. It can be a mile away from where it is now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the fire itself is running along at 80 miles per hour, but yes, those winds are fueling it really, really fast. I mean, people really only have a couple moments to get out of their houses, just like you mentioned, when they come up for evacuation orders. I spoke to a colleague who is in Altadena, where there's a fire up there in the foothills that really just exploded overnight, and he says they only got about 40 minutes. Like, it went from nothing to being apocalyptic in just under an hour. And so those are the fires that we know of. And then there continue to be these little spot fires. As you mentioned, a lot of them are fueled by embers that are being picked up and carried by the wind and dropped, in some cases, up to a mile away from the actual fire line. So it's just a very volatile and dangerous situation. And firefighters are just stuck in this constant game of whack-a-mole.
As we're talking, I guess the sun is about to come up in Southern California. Do you have any sense of the extent of the damage here?
No, not yet. And I'm guessing from some areas you wouldn't know that the sun is coming up because it's so smoky. But yeah, we're still in the midst of these fires, and there is no telling exactly the damage. We have heard that potentially up to 20,000 structures have burned so far.
Liz Baker of NPR News in Southern California, thanks very much for your reporting all morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
From fire, we're going to turn to the dangers of ice. It's been a rough week for the U.S. air travel system. A powerful winter storm forced airlines to cancel thousands of flights and delay thousands more. And a second storm is set to hit before the weekend. NPR's Joel Rose reports on how airlines keep their planes flying safely in foul weather.
When the temperature plunges, the de-icing crews go to work. First, the big truck pulls up alongside a plane. Then the worker in the bucket sprays the wings, tail, and fuselage with a mixture of hot fluids that melts snow and ice so the plane can take off safely.
Yeah, you're in the elements, it's snowing, you can barely see sometimes.
That's Thomas Stevenson, a de-icer for Southwest Airlines based in Denver, in a video the company posted on YouTube.
It definitely gets cold, but I mean, that's something you kind of signed up for when you took the job. So, you know, it's still fun. We still have a lot of fun out here.
The job is critical for airlines to operate safely in the winter months. Kathleen Bangs is a former airline pilot who's now a spokesperson for FlightAware, the flight tracking website. Bangs says planes need to have clean wings in order to take off safely with no contamination of any kind.
Not just heavy snow, but actually very thin layers of frost can also have a very negative effect on lift, and then the aircraft will no longer be able to fly due to this contaminated surface.
When de-icing is not done properly, the results can be catastrophic, like in January of 1982.
Air Florida Flight 90 had crashed on takeoff in a blinding snowstorm. It hit a bridge crowded with commuter traffic, then plunged into the icy Potomac River.
That Air Florida flight crashed moments after taking off from what was then called Washington National Airport, killing almost everyone on board. That accident led to more rigorous standards for de-icing. The process generally takes about 10 to 20 minutes for a smaller plane. For larger jets, it can add a delay of 40 minutes or more for each flight. But the airlines have gotten pretty good at it, says Chris Mano, a retired pilot who spent 35 years flying for American Airlines.
It's just one of those frustrating times of year, and everything's being done safely. It's just, there's no good way to do it other than slowly.
De-icing crews may be hard at work again this week. Another major winter storm is expected to bring snow and freezing rain to a wide stretch of the South, from Dallas to Atlanta and the Carolinas. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
In announcing the end of fact-checking on Facebook and Instagram, Mark Zuckerberg said it had gone too far.
We've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship.
Zuckerberg is the person who instituted fact-checking on Facebook years ago, but he now says fact-checkers have been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they have created, thus matching his opinion with the incoming Trump administration, where senior figures have criticized fact-checking and talked about acting against tech companies. We should note that Meta is a sponsor of NPR, but we cover them like any other company. And we've called Steve Brill, who is the co-founder of NewsGuard, where journalists rate the reliability of news sources. NewsGuard has faced some of the same criticism as Facebook.
Good morning. How are you?
What do you make of Zuckerberg's announcement that fact-checking, even from Zuckerberg, who said he was in favor of it once upon a time, has gone too far?
Well, I have to concede that listening to your earlier report about the fires in California, that to me is the equivalent of saying we've overreacted to climate change and we need to stop worrying about it, and we need to ease up on our efforts to deal with the climate. The idea that we should ease up on our efforts to keep Russian and Chinese and Iranian disinformation out of our social feeds is just ridiculous. It's just plain ridiculous. It's like he's living in an alternate universe.
Well, let's talk through what's happening here. Did you regard it as censorship when Facebook users call attention to a post that they think is doubtful or wrong? Fact checkers check it out. I believe it remains on the site, usually, but there might be some kind of notice attached. Did that strike you as censorship?
When private people or private companies speak, it's called editing, not censorship. If the New York Times or NPR decides that this interview is wrong or that I'm not being responsible, you have a responsibility to edit me out. That's your job.
So you're viewing Meta as a publisher then, that they should actually take some responsibility for what they publish?
Of course they should, because look at what they've been responsible for in the past. Right now, the Meta platforms are overrun by Chinese and Russian and Iranian disinformation. Right now, they're overrun by healthcare hoaxes, and they should take responsibility for that, not necessarily by blocking anything, but by giving their users some sense about the reliability of who is speaking to them.
I wonder if the very thing that you're saying to me, though, is an argument for change, because you're telling me, essentially, that fact-checking hasn't worked. Fact-checking hasn't kept misinformation from people. There's a lot of it out there. Go ahead.
It can't work because it's after the fact. The Facebook fact-checking, they were responding to the political pressure they were getting in 2016, and now they're responding in a different direction to the different political pressure they're getting. None of it is based on the principle that if you're going to be a republisher, you have all the freedom in the world, but you also have an obligation to be a responsible publisher.
Would you have them delete speech? Because, I mean, I know people on the right were concerned about that, but now that Elon Musk is running Twitter, people on the left might really have a problem with billionaires deleting speech.
I don't think people should block anything. I think they should give people more information about who is speaking to them.
Your company, NewsGuard, tries to give people more information about who is speaking to them by rating the reliability of different news sources and different news stories. What have you thought about the criticism that you have increasingly faced by people who are connected with or even in the new administration?
Well, we face that same kind of criticism from people on the left as well as people on the right. And, you know, it's what we signed up for. We give MSNBC a lower rating than we give, Fox News. And you can only imagine the criticism we got from the left about that.
And you're just trying in each case to say, this is a reliable source, this is a reliable story. You give it a number, a score, and you go from
there. It's based on 9 specific standards of journalistic practice. You know, do you have a corrections policy? Do your headlines match what your story is? It's our best effort. It doesn't mean it should be the only effort. It doesn't mean that others shouldn't be out there trying to compete with us, but it's what we try to do, and everything we do is completely transparent.
Stephen Brill is the co-founder of NewsGuard and the author of The Death of Truth, among many other things. Thanks for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Oscar winner Tilda Swinton talks about death, grief, her love of costumes and androgynous style, and why she doesn't think of herself as an actor. In The Room Next Door, Swinton portrays a woman who has suffered from cancer and, after therapies haven't worked, intends to end her life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Jimmy Carter, who lies in state today at the Capitol, was a small-d Democratic leader. That means embracing debate and criticism, which Carter did during his presidency and long afterward. When he gave his opinion about Israel, it provoked opinions about him.
As you know, I've been called an anti-Semite. I've been called a bigot. I've been called senile. I've been called a liar. I've been called a plagiarist.
That was Carter in 2007 on NPR. He'd written a book titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Though Carter once had brokered a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, critics denounced his use of the word apartheid. They combed the book for errors, and people connected with his own Carter Center resigned. So I asked him if he would take our questions. We now play the main part of our conversation, which feels as relevant today as it did in 2007. Could you just make briefly the best case you can for why apartheid is the right word to use?
Well, I'll try to make a perfect case. Apartheid is a word that is an accurate description of what has been going on in the West Bank, and it's based on the desire or avarice of a minority of Israelis for Palestinian land. It's not based on racism. Those caveats are very clearly made in the book. This is a word that's a very accurate description of the forced separation within the West Bank of Israelis from Palestinians and the total domination and oppression of Palestinians by the dominant Israeli military.
Why not just describe that rather than bring in this word that's freighted with so much history from another place?
It would be hard to give that definition that I've just given you in the title of a book. The book is quite descriptive.
Would you describe for us, simply because the book has been criticized for its details, how'd you write the book?
How did I write it? On my word processor, on a computer. I wrote every word myself. I never have had any co-authors. I based it on my, you might say, 33 years of experience. I doubt, even when I was, after I left office, I traveled extensively in the Middle East. I doubt that any other prominent human being has been blessed with such a great opportunity as I have to actually know what's going on now.
Well, you've been challenged in your recollections of meetings, for example, with Hafez al-Assad, the one-time president of Syria, and it's been alleged that your description of Assad makes him look more reasonable and the Israelis look less reasonable than might actually have been the case. What was your version based on? Did you go back to notes and other documents that you had from the time?
Of course. I began meeting with Hafez al-Assad when I was president, trying to get him to support a peace process. And on one occasion, he invited me to meet with him and his entire family. And I met all his children and got to know them.
But when you recollect, for example, your 1990 meeting with him, at which you asked about the Golan Heights,
yes,
how that dispute might be settled with Israel, were you working from your own notes?
Of course, my own notes. And my wife takes notes when I'm there, and we have been very careful to make sure that all those descriptions are accurate.
Ken Stein, as you know, former colleague of yours at the Carter Center, has alleged that his recollection of that meeting is somewhat different.
Ken Stein was a professor that I took along with me, and Ken attended some of the meetings with me and the more highly sensitive meetings. I was the only one there except my wife to take notes.
Oh, you're saying that he did not go to all the meetings that you went to?
Of course, that's right.
There's also been some criticism of a sentence on page 213 of your book.
That was a terribly worded sentence, which implied, obviously, in a ridiculous way, that I approved terrorism and terrorist acts against Israeli citizens.
The sentence said that Palestinians and Arabs in general should end suicide bombings and other acts of terrorism when international law and the ultimate goals of the roadmap for peace are accepted.
Yeah, was obviously a crazy and stupid word. My publishers have been informed about that. They've changed the sentence in all future editions of the book.
You mentioned that you've been labeled an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
You do use the word apartheid in the title of your book, which
is accurate.
Defenders of Israel regarded as a label that called into a lot of bad associations. Whether you agree with any specific charge there, would you agree that kind of labeling is not very productive?
I think it's productive. I had two basic hopes for this book. One, that it would stimulate peace talks. Secondly, that it would reveal for the first time to the American public the horrible oppression and persecution of the Palestinian people, and that it would precipitate for the first time any substantive debate on these issues.
And one other thing, Mr. President, one of the most fascinating parts of this book to me is an area that has not been as controversial. It's one of the earlier passages in which you describe a time when you were governor of Georgia and you were invited to Israel by the government of Israel to look around, and you ended up standing on the banks of the Jordan River. Could you describe what you did there and how that affected you?
I was given complete freedom to go where I wished. There was a security border along the Jordan River, and there was a gate, and I got permission from one of the guards to go, and I waded out in the Jordan River at the same site that I felt, from my own knowledge of Christianity, that Jesus Christ was baptized. So we just immersed ourselves in the culture and biblical history and current political affairs of Israel in that visit.
And if I may just read a sentence from that passage. You write at the end of this visit, "We left convinced that the Israelis were dominant but just, the Arabs quiescent because their rights were being protected, and the political and military situation destined to remain stable until land was swapped for peace."
That's exactly right. And the premise then, you have to realize that at that time there were only 1,500 total Israeli settlers in the entire occupied territories. This was before the massive Israeli confiscation of land and colonization of the choice sites. But the premise then, undisputed, was that Israel would soon withdraw from the occupied territories. And so that impression that I had was quite accurate at the time.
Can you think of one event or series of events that has caused your view to change so dramatically over those years?
Yes, the apparently permanent acquisition, confiscation, and colonization of choice sites throughout the West Bank. The Israelis have taken away from the Palestinians, apparently with ideas by some Israelis to keep those areas permanently. That's the root of the problem that presents peace coming to the Mideast.
Well, Mr. President, thanks for taking the time.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Former President Jimmy Carter questioned on NPR in 2007. His funeral is tomorrow. This is NPR News.
Green crabs are a highly invasive species wreaking havoc on the West Coast. Luckily, humans have a cute and cuddly helper when it comes to population control, sea otters.
It's really a win-win scenario if we can support a native threatened species, the sea otter, which helps control an invasive invertebrate.
That research on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Los Angeles and Ventura County are among the areas of Southern California under a state of emergency because of wildfires burning out of control. Two of the largest fires in LA County have blackened more than 5,000 acres, the Palisades Fire and the Eaton Fire. Thousands of people are under evacuation orders, and a number of homes have been destroyed. As Steve Futterman reports, strong winds are spreading the flames and currently grounding firefighting aircraft.
These gusts are going to continue for a while. Right now, these fires are spreading and they are burning, and more homes are being destroyed.
Some wind gusts have been topping 80 miles per hour. The Hearst Fire, north of Los Angeles, has burned at least 500 acres. California Governor Gavin Newsom is describing the fires as unprecedented for L.A. Americans are paying their final respects to former President Jimmy Carter. His flag-draped casket is lying in state at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda ahead of his state funeral. That'll take place tomorrow at Washington National Cathedral. Carter died late last month at the age of 100. Dallas and Little Rock are among the cities in the southern U.S. under a winter storm warning. The two areas are expected to see snow and perhaps sleet tomorrow into tomorrow night. This is NPR News from Washington. Search teams in Tibet say they're battling cold temperatures as they look through the rubble for more survivors of yesterday's deadly earthquake. Tents and blankets have been arriving in the region where thousands of people have lost their homes. The death toll tops 125. Nearly 200 others were injured. Ashish Valentine has more.
China's vice premier Zhang Guoqing has arrived to supervise rescue efforts. It's tough work, especially as temperatures drop below freezing in the nighttime. That's Shigatse's deputy mayor Liu Huazhong at a news conference. He broke into tears announcing the dead and wounded. Authorities have restored power to the largest city of Tigri and relocated more than 30,000 people. Tents, quilts, and other relief items are being delivered to people whose homes are uninhabitable or unsafe. For NPR News, I'm Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
The body of a British hiker missing in the Alps since New Year's Day has been found by Italian authorities. They're still searching for a person who was with him. Italy's Alpine Service says snow, fog, and avalanche warnings slowed their search during the last couple of days. But they say conditions improved today, and they were able to use a helicopter to reach the pair's last known location. On Wall Street moments ago, stocks opened lower. The Dow is off 61 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The winter holidays are behind us. Winter definitely is not.
It's cold and snowy in many places, and it's time for another annual tradition, the winter respiratory virus season.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is with us now to tell us more. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Michelle.
All right, give it to me straight. How bad is it?
It's pretty bad out there right now. You know, Michelle, people love to travel and get together with family and friends over the holidays. The bad news is that often means they come home with some nasty bug. I talked about this with Dr. Brendan Jackson from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Respiratory season is here. It is getting to be in full swing now. With a lot of people getting sick, a lot of people missing work, missing school, just feeling lousy in general.
And you know, Michelle, the flu in particular is spiking right now. Here's Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease researcher at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville.
We're buried with influenza. Things are very, very busy and intense. The emergency room is full of people who are coughing and sneezing. We've had people waiting on gurneys, those stretchers, waiting for admission. We are really full.
And it's not just the flu. RSV is still spreading at very high levels. So is whooping cough, a bacterium called mycoplasma that can cause walking pneumonia. And let's not forget COVID, which is starting to shoot up yet again.
Oh, so how bad is it going to get this winter?
Well, you know, no one ever really knows with these viruses. The CDC says that unless some new COVID variant emerges, it still looks like this winter will probably be kind of like last year. But that's not great. It still means lots of kids missing school, parents missing work, grandparents and other vulnerable people ending up in the hospital and even dying. Dr. Andrew Pavia studies infectious disease at the University of Utah.
We've got three viruses that are going to hit with peaks that are going to be relatively closely spaced so that as one starts to go down, the other is going to start peaking and we're just not going to get a break. They're like a series of snowstorms. What it means, I think, is that we're in for a pretty miserable January before things start to let up.
But even then, a long tail, according to Caitlin Rivers. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins.
The winter respiratory virus season often peaks in December or January, but it lingers through the spring months. And so I do think we have several more weeks, if not months, left of this sick season.
So Rivers and others are recommending people should do all the, you know, usual stuff. Wash their hands a lot, mask up in crowded places, open windows if they can, and of course, get vaccinated. It's not too late.
Well, before we let you go, what is this other virus that I've been hearing about?
Yeah, it's called the human metapneumovirus, or HMPV. It's getting a lot of attention because of a surge of respiratory illnesses in the north of China. But the World Health Organization and the CDC say they aren't too worried about it. The WHO says the increase in respiratory illness cases seen in China is within the range expected for this time of year. HMPV can cause serious complications, but usually only causes a cold. It's nothing compared to the flu, RSV, and COVID, which according to a new CDC estimate is still killing hundreds of people every week.
That is NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thank you.
You bet, Michelle.
A NASA rover on Mars has been collecting samples of rock and sealing them into metal tubes. NASA wants to launch a robotic mission that would pick up these samples and would return them to Earth, but it's been a challenge. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has an update.
Samples of rock have been brought back from the moon, from asteroids, but never from another planet. So when NASA designed the Perseverance rover, they sent along tubes made of titanium. The rover has been busy filling them up with samples of rocks, dirt, the Martian atmosphere. NASA wants to bring 30 of these tubes back to Earth so that their contents can be analyzed in a secure lab. The goal is to learn more about the history of the red planet, such as whether it ever had life.
We want to have the quickest, cheapest way to get these 30 samples back.
That's NASA Administrator Bill Nelson speaking at a press briefing on Tuesday. He says the original plan to get the rocks back was turning out to be slow and expensive. Projected costs ballooned to $11 billion, with a return date as far off as 2040.
This thing had gotten out of control.
So last year, top officials pulled the plug and hit the reset button. NASA solicited ideas from industry and outside experts. And now, Nelson says, NASA will spend some time simultaneously exploring two different mission options. One will rely on tried and true technologies for getting to Mars that have been used in previous missions, plus simplified components of the original plan. The other option will take advantage of emerging commercial capabilities. NASA will work on the engineering for both and eventually pick one.
The final decision is likely to come in 2026.
Planetary scientists, who have long been eager to bring Mars rocks home, paid close attention to his words. Jack Mustard is with Brown University.
I'm heartened to hear the administrator say, you know, I can see a path forward. I mean, I think that's the bottom line, right? They see a path forward.
That was by no means guaranteed. This sense of relief was echoed by Vicky Hamilton, a planetary geologist with the Southwest Research Institute, although she had been hoping to hear what the mission would look like.
I am disappointed a little bit that we still don't know exactly what the architecture will be.
Still, she says NASA really hasn't had much time to think about the various proposals it got from industry.
So I can understand that they want to take a little more time to look at that.
And she was happy to hear that NASA wants to retrieve all 30 samples rather than making do with a smaller selection. She says these carefully assembled samples could reveal whether or not Mars was ever home to ancient life.
We're going to the right place and collecting the right samples to do the best job we can at trying to answer that question.
The incoming Trump administration and Congress will weigh in on all this, plus the European Space Agency, NASA's partner in this effort. Meanwhile, China has been pursuing its own project to collect and return a Martian rock. Nelson called it more of a grab-and-go mission. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
As Washington prepares for the funeral of President Jimmy Carter this week, we look at the history and significance of presidential funerals. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. A man in Illinois was helping his parents renovate their bathroom when he found something in the walls. It was a box wrapped in red wrapping paper, and it had his name written on it. He opened the present and found model airplanes from around 1978. His parents don't remember buying the gift, but the man says his parents used to hide gifts in the attic, and this one likely fell into a crawl space. A belated Merry Christmas to him. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. at UMA.com/NPR. And from Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rockstars. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. More and more Americans need home health care, and finding a caregiver is hard. The pay is low, turnover is high, which is why Nevada has been raising caregiver wages. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
Thomas Dre is a high school science teacher. Almost 20 years ago, he was in a car crash.
Yeah, in 2005, my buddy ran a red light.
He suffered a spinal injury that left him unable to use his legs. Since then, he's needed help getting out of bed, getting cleaned, getting dressed, and getting in his van to go to school. That help hasn't always been reliable.
We have people coming and going or not showing up to get me up, and I wouldn't go to school that day.
Then came Irma Nunez. For the past 12 years, she's been at his house 20-some hours a week.
What is it, 23?
Like 23, 24 and a half, around there. Mm-hmm.
That's how much Medicaid covers every week.
I come a.m. and I come p.m. every single day.
In the mornings, she's there at 4:30 so that Dre can make it to school by 6 a.m., an hour before the kids get there.
I wouldn't be able to go to school or work if it wasn't for Irma.
After school, she returns to help Dre get back into his house and back into bed. The work is taxing. And a year ago, she was earning the going rate, around $11 an hour.
I always thought it was just crazy they made such little amount of money.
To make ends meet, Nunez used to pick up as much work as she could, taking on multiple clients, driving from house to house, a couple hours here, a couple hours there, 7 days a week.
You see a lot of people needing you, so you help them. You know, you help them, and that makes you feel good.
Still, she was frustrated, not just with her low pay, but her lack of health insurance and other benefits.
No PTO, no vacations, no nothing. I don't work, I don't get paid.
So she jumped at the chance to do something about it. In 2023, she and other caregivers took their fight to the Nevada legislature with backing from the union, SEIU. They asked the state to send more Medicaid dollars to the agencies that employ them, so the agencies in turn could pay them more. The caregivers shined a light on how hard their days are, bathing and feeding patients, helping them go to the bathroom. Turned out they had a receptive audience.
People told us personal stories about their dads, moms, grandparents, so they knew what we were talking about.
And in the 2023 budget bill, Nevada lawmakers granted their wishes. They even set a new $16 minimum wage for home care workers, far higher than the state minimum wage. It took effect in January last year.
First paycheck, I'm all like, oh, wow, like way different.
Now, a year later, the wage boost is proving to be game-changing for the industry, too. It used to be that half of home care workers in Nevada didn't even last a year. In the 4 months after the new minimum wage took effect, turnover fell to almost nothing. Home health agencies have been growing their ranks at a faster clip, and so has the union. Since 2023, 1,000 caregivers have voted to unionize to have a bigger voice. And when the Nevada legislature convenes again next month, Irma Nunez will be part of a larger contingent of caregivers demanding another raise.
Maybe from 16 to 20, or if possible, higher, because we need it.
She says her rent keeps going up. Her car needs new tires. She still has no health insurance. And at 58, she herself is dealing with all kinds of health problems.
I'm older. I'm older, and I'm not the Irma that used to be.
A $20 wage, she says, would help her save a little money for her own retirement. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Henderson, Nevada.
This is NPR News. Thank you. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Donald Trump Jr. is back in the U.S. today after flying to Greenland yesterday. He brought this message from his father, the president-elect.
He says hello. We were talking to him yesterday, so he says hello to everyone in Greenland.
What you heard there was Donald Trump Jr.'s arrival in the Capitol Nuuk as captured by the Greenlandic broadcaster KNR. It was classified as a private trip, but his father has been increasingly vocal, one might say even aggressive, about the U.S. buying Greenland. Here's the president-elect also on Tuesday when he was asked if he'd rule out using military or economic coercion to take control of Greenland and the Panama Canal.
No, I can't assure you on either of those two, but I can say this. We need them for economic security.
We wanted to get a Greenlandic perspective on this, so we've called Kuno Fenker. He is a member of Greenland's parliament and a member of the center-right party that favors independence from Denmark. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you, too.
So this issue of President Trump's interest in Greenland came up during his first term in office. I don't know that people took it that seriously, but he seems to be kind of serious now. What do you make of it?
I think he's always been serious, and as a politician he and a businessman, he always speaks frankly and honestly. So I must say that the remarks that he's saying about Greenland are quite honest, and depending on how you interpret them, we can fully understand what he's saying. And it's about the security of the American continent and the Arctic and even our allies. And there's a big need in regards to bigger securitization and dual-use equipment here in Greenland. So I can fully understand him. And he's mentioning also Chinese vessels, Russian vessels, maybe that could be...
Can I just briefly interrupt? Is it your view that Denmark, the government of Denmark, is not taking the security concerns seriously enough?
Yeah, exactly. They haven't taken them seriously enough, and I also commented on that quite frankly a couple of days ago. It will be in the media soon. And that is about search and rescue, that is inspection of fishing vessels and other vessels coming to our waters here in Greenland. It's also surveillance of Greenland. It's about the security and for the people and getting some dual-use equipment to Greenland. It's quite urgent.
So local media reports said that there were some people at the airport in Nuuk wearing red MAGA hats. Wasn't there, so I don't know if you know that should be true too, but is there support among Greenlanders for some sort of closer ties to the U.S.?
Sure. We are willing to work in an honorable manner with our allies and the near neighbors, the U.S., Canada, and even Denmark as such.
To the question of whether the U.S. could buy Greenland, is that an option?
It's not an option, but, you know, some people say that Denmark owns us, and it's, in a way, in a sense, true, because Denmark has the sovereignty of Greenland because they annexed us in 1953, and we don't want to repeat that again ever. So the future of Greenland is decided by the Greenlandic people.
That is Kuno Fenker. He is a member of Greenland's parliament from the Siamut party. Mr. Fenker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Prosthetics can make a huge difference in the quality of life for people born without a limb or people who've had one amputated, but making them for kids is particularly challenging. That's because kids grow so fast and outgrow them, and because of the tiny movements needed for the hands to work. But now 3D printing is improving kids' options. Joe Mario Pedersen, Central Florida Public Media Health reporter, tells us more.
Eloise Bayless is 12 years old. She plays soccer, she fishes, and plays 5 instruments. And she does all of that, and more, with one hand.
I'm one of those outdoor kids. I'm not one of those who, like, stays inside all day long. I mean, I love playing Nerf guns with my friend next door, Caden. And I'll draw. I love playing video games, too.
Eloise does a lot of things. She was born with one hand. She's had a lot of prosthetic arms, too. Her mother, Elizabeth, says 10 years ago, there weren't great options.
She needs a hand to do this, or she wants an attachment for her bike. And there were, like, adult-sized things, or just people that really weren't didn't know the skill of making pediatric prosthetics, right? And then they weren't functional. They didn't do anything.
For the last 3 months, Eloise has been using what she says is the best prosthetic yet, a 3D printed arm which allows her to lift 30 pounds and grips things tightly by twitching small muscles near her elbow. Those twitches activate sensors that manipulate the robotic fingers. Here, Eloise is explaining how she has a bit of fun with her friends by grabbing a hold of their hand.
I can break my friends so hard at school with it. Oh, I just do this to them. And they cannot get out of what they do.
One could argue the reason she can prank her friends is because Albert Manero was driving his car and listening to an NPR story about the difficulties of child prosthetics 10 years ago.
You speak, they could be too heavy, too expensive, they need to really grow with the child.
Manero was an engineering student in Central Florida at the time. The story inspired him to make one of the first 3D printed arms for a child with the help of 14 fellow students. Now, he's the president of a nonprofit, Limitless Solutions. They donate arms to kids who need them.
In the United States, for children, it's particularly difficult to get access to prosthetics for a number of reasons.
For one, most health insurers don't cover child prosthetics. They are often deemed not medically necessary, and the mechanical ones used to be really expensive.
3D printing answers that issue.
University of Florida engineering professor Dan Ferris says Manero's invention makes it cheaper.
You can just quickly and easily replace parts to change the size without having to totally redesign the whole package.
In Eloise Bayless's case, she's sporting a 3D arm with a Disney Princess Moana design that cost the family about $20,000, but it will be easier and cheaper to update and replace parts as she grows.
Are you serious? This is so cool.
She's still getting used to her new arm and fully using two hands. She's had some trial and error success at riding a bike.
I got so nervous because I couldn't feel it, like where it was, and I thought I was going to fall over like 10 times or crash into a mailbox again.
The one hobby she hasn't tried her new hand at yet is video games, which she mastered with just one.
I mean, I'm going to be really nervous actually trying it like this because how do you even play a game with two hands?
While she figures that out, prosthetic arm engineers are expecting even more developments in the next 10 years that will make them cheaper and even more useful. For NPR News, I'm Joe Mario Pedersen in Orlando.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a little novelty here for you this evening. We'll have a little argument between the saxophones and the trumpet. Of course, these cats just told me they're going to get away. And the little trumpet just said it's going to do the same. Ain't that right, little trumpet? Say, yes, sir. Oh, that little devil. But before we riff, we're going to chirp a few for you this time. So get your chops together, boys. While we mug lightly, slightly, and politely.
Chinatown, my Chinatown, where the lights are loud.